Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. We have spoken quite a lot on these podcasts about the dire state of children's mental health across the country. We know, for example, that one out of every four children in the United States qualifies for mental health treatment, but tragically, only 25% of those children actually get help. According to a White House report released in May 2022, between the year 2008 and 2019, the percentage of adolescents that reported having experienced at least one major depressive episode in the past year increased nearly 90% from 8.3% in 2008 to 15.7% in 2019. Over roughly the same period, suicide death rates among individuals aged 10 to 24 years of age increased 47%. Despite these grim statistics, we invest substantial dollars into mental health services. According to the 2022 White House report, $280 billion were spent on mental health treatment in 2020. Since the pandemic, those numbers have only increased, with massive amounts of one-time dollars allocated to increasing mental health services in public schools. Looking at a breakdown of where these dollars are invested, however, tells an interesting story. While we are spending a great deal of money on mental health treatment, there is very little allocated to emotional and psychological wellness, or the kinds of programs that might serve to prevent mental health struggles later in life. According to the 2022 Children Now California Report Card, children's success hinges on the support of caring, effective, trauma-informed, and culturally competent, congruent adults. Yet, California schools continue to have fewer educators, counselors, nurses, and support staff than almost every other state in the country. Only 57% of ninth graders report having a caring relationship with even one adult at school, despite our knowing that adults on campus have always been critical to student well-being and are more important than ever during turbulent times. The recommendation of Children Now is that California policymakers promote systemic changes in our schools to significantly improve student experiences, ensure a positive school climate, and increase student engagement and connectedness. They specifically call for a reinvestment in services and programs that attend to the socio-emotional needs of children, which will lead to better educational achievement and ideally the prevention of mental health struggles and isolation down the road. Until we do a better job of incorporating programs that enhance emotional well-being, there are nonprofits that are stepping up to fill that gap. In today's podcast, we're going to speak with Tiffany Reckley, an instructional supervisor and professional development specialist with Education Through Music Los Angeles. Tiffany has extensive work, knowledge and research and best practices of social emotional learning in music classrooms. We will learn about the programs her organization provides and how music education in schools can improve the emotional, psychological, and educational outcomes of our children. Wow. Welcome, Tiffany. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to meet you for my benefit, because we haven't met before, and for the benefit of our listeners. Could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Of course. Thank you so much for having me today. I am a music educator, super proud to have chosen this career path, or it chose me. But I was originally born in New York City, born and raised in Brooklyn, and to a mother who is an educator. So it's like, I guess it runs in the family. And as I got older, I knew I was going to be in the arts some sort of way. Like, that was just my niche. And so I actually fell into music pretty late, right around high school, and it just changed my life. So after that, I was determined, I'm going to go into music. And I started on my journey to, like, really understanding the difference between not having the years prior to, you know, there are some people that start music when they're 5, 6, and, you know, you kind of see that when you're going into auditions and things. But I was just so determined. And so I have an undergraduate degree in music education from Xavier University of Louisiana. And then I have a master's of music education degree from the University of North Texas. I also have postgraduate credits in school counseling and community counseling that I also feel like have just kind of played a huge role in my journey. With so many years of experience across K-12 and in a lot of the environments that we're going to talk about today, it was time for me to make that transition into administration. So I'm really happy to be in the position I am in now, which is an instructional supervisor and professional development specialist.
That's very impressive. Thank you. And again, thank you for being here. And could you please tell us a little bit about your organization, Education Through Music Los Angeles?
Sure. So Education Through Music is originally founded in New York City in 1991. It was set up to address the inequities that were in New York City public schools at the time. And they realized, hey, we noticed that the outcomes actually improve when schools have arts education, specifically music education. And so our executive director here at ETM LA, Victoria Lanier, she started there as a music teacher and eventually moved up to a music supervisor. And later her journey brought her here to Los Angeles, and she realized that there was a huge need for the same thing here in LA. And so she created ETM LA. We just celebrated our 17th year. So we're really excited for the next 17 years and beyond. But, you know, we are a very close-knit network. We have several bases in New York. We have one in Massachusetts, Colorado, and here in Los Angeles. So, you know, we try to stay true to our mission, stay true to our core, which is comprehensive sequential music education. And we also make sure that we structure ourselves to address some of the things that are systemically needing to be addressed in order to have those comprehensive programs. So being able to train our teachers and being able to bring parents and communities into the learning, making sure that, you know, when we are going into classrooms, that we're being culturally relevant and, you know, that we're addressing some of those social emotional learning needs. So there are just so many aspects that we try and make sure we cover to not only just have a program, but have a quality program as well.
Excellent. Thank you. You know, I'm a mom myself. I've raised twin sons in the public schools systems, but I'm not sure everybody fully understands the inequities across school districts and across schools. So, and I do understand that ETMLA serves historically under-resourced school districts. And could you describe for our listeners what this might mean and how it impacts music education?
Yes. So there are wonderful pockets here in Los Angeles of just areas that have such great history and music and traditions and food and resources that are of the community. And there are some areas where those resources, you know, have been drained, and that, you know, some communities have been destroyed and, you know, people are still left. families are still left, communities are still left. But, you know, because we're looking at a bigger socio-ecosystem, you know, we're realizing that everyone is not receiving what I guess we would consider fair across the board, right? So if we're looking at a school district, there are just so many different things at play. That's why you'll see one campus may be brand new and another campus may be falling apart. You'll see some inequities like that in just the resources they receive, the quality of instruction that they're receiving. And it's very hard for educators to who are trained in these, you know, methods of this is a typical classroom. You're not always trained to go into a classroom that does not have the items, sometimes the basic items that you may need to teach, like pencils and crayons, or, you know, you may not have adequate facilities. And so these are just some of the things that we would recognize in like under-resourced schools. I tend to explain to people that, you know, the lack of funding is a big thing that you see, but the thing that you don't see is what other resources can you draw from the community, from the students, from the faculty. And so when we're looking at music education in these schools, it's a huge value because it may seem like nobody cares. There's nothing there. They are just like the forgotten children. And so it's really nice for us to be able to, you know, go in and create that space for students to be themselves, to be creative, to find their light, and to really get them to feel some connectedness and be inspired. So I think that that's definitely how we're able to impact, you know, through music education. But it is hard, you know, when you go into a classroom and you may not have the resources and supplies you need, you have to create what you need to create.
You have to improvise. Yes. You know, I'd like to drill down a little bit on that because under-resourced communities, of course, typically include children and families who themselves then experience trauma from poverty, from being historically marginalized, from being disadvantaged. What impact have you seen on those children who are growing up within these communities, these children who have been historically and intentionally excluded?
Yeah, so we see a lot of different things in the classroom. Just from the educator perspective, music aside, you know, there are some things where students may not have access to regular health care, dental care, vision care, things that we may take for granted or, you know, that we don't realize is a privilege. There are some times that you're walking into a classroom and you might think a student isn't paying attention. They may be paying attention. They probably just can't see, but they haven't seen an eye doctor to go and, you know, receive glasses or something like that. So, you know, sometimes we'll see that and then that will create other behaviors. And we know that all behaviors are communication, right? And so sometimes, you know, we've seen these after effects of the trauma. It's kind of like secondhand almost for some of our students, where they're doing the best they can with what they have, but even with what they have, they're still not able to do their best. And then I also think that, you know, just from a poverty standpoint, you know, we have some students where you have to understand the poverty mindset in society. And again, it's a bigger systemic ecosystem out there. You can't look at education as an individual thing. You have to look at like this big microcosm. But even through poverty, those who have a poverty mindset will receive money and they're looking for something that's instantly gratifying. They don't look at money as something that I can have long term, that I should grow, I should invest. If I don't have it today and I have it tomorrow, I need to use it tomorrow. And so sometimes what we'll see is, you know, a lot of people will sometimes be a little judgmental and they'll say, oh, the parent bought them new shoes, but they don't have pencils. It's not that the parent doesn't care or value the education. It literally is that that gratification is going straight into what does my kid need? What's going to make them happy? How are they going to be able to walk through the neighborhood and things like that? And all of that comes into the play in the classroom. You know, a student may come in and they're not prepared and, you know, now they're getting in trouble because they don't have their necessities when it's like, just give them some loose leaf, give them a pencil, you know? So sometimes, again, we have to be able to step outside of ourselves as well. And I think that there are kids who, since the pandemic, one of the things that I've noticed is schools that save space for a lot of students. So if they're going home and there's trauma there, you know, parents are stressed out, there might be some type of abuse, or, you know, maybe there's some type of neglect or anything like that, students will still come to school. And there's going to be that safe space. During the pandemic, they were at home. So sometimes they could never leave that abuse or those traumas, and they were seeing them firsthand. And so, you know, they have come back slightly different. They've come back very affected. They were witnessing things happening that they never had to witness before. And it's hard, especially because there aren't very many people who are helping our students deal with the traumas that they've experienced.
I mean, you're so right about that. I have said over and over that safer at home wasn't safe for a pretty significant percentage of our population. But given this backdrop that you've painted, it resonates very much with me. In my job as a clinical social worker, I've gone into schools to do work where there weren't enough desks and kids were sitting on the counters in the back. I mean, they literally didn't even have enough desks for all the students. So of all the challenges that these kids have, that these schools have, your program is bringing music education into these academically vulnerable schools. With all the challenges they're facing, why music? Why is it important to provide these children with exposure to music in their education? Like, why should we care about that?
Yes. Well, I think that and I still feel like I'm young, but at this point in my career, I'm starting to become a veteran now, but I still think of myself pretty young. But in my years, I've definitely seen some of these vulnerable populations where their parents went to the same schools. They've been failed by those schools. Now their kids have no choice but to go to those schools. And they're feeling as though their children are being failed by those schools as well, right? And so there's a distrust there. And that's kind of hard to sometimes work through. But I also feel like parents want the best for their children, and they want to be a partner in their learning. And so when I think about what music does, it brings families together in the learning, right? Because who doesn't engage in music? And music is one of those subject areas that just, again, it does so much, not just for the socio-emotional, but just academically. We're seeing both sides of the brain fire off. We're seeing students who are able to be creative and vulnerable and expressive, and they don't typically get to do that in other subject areas. I love the fact that we can walk into a classroom where kids have been sitting for 8 hours a day and then have them move and sing a song, and then you see them the next week and they're like, I was moving and singing that song all week. You know, it's like, okay, sure. Yeah. That's your jam. That's your jam. You know, Mary Had a Little Lamb. But it's, you know, it's also a connecting point for students as well, because everybody is kind of starting from the same place. You know, it's not, are you smarter than me in music? Am I better than you? It's like, no, we're all talented. And collectively, it's no one person over the other. The way we make this work is that it's all of us. And so every kid finds that they have a place or a role. And if not music, then some other area, right? Every kid is not going to be a STEM kid. You know, some students are going to be more drawn to the arts. And, you know, they should be able to see that there is viability in that, that there is a life that you can have in that. If there's something that you're interested in and being exposed to that through, you know, your learning, then that's even better. And I think that that's what music does. I remember teaching some middle schoolers and they were like, all you can do is teach music or perform. And I was like, absolutely not. You know, if you want to be someone who's a sound engineer, if you want to be, you know, someone who's in production or behind the camera or, you know, producing and engineering, like, this is one of the arts capitals in the world. You can be in anything, you know? And so kids didn't even realize, like, those were some of the options. And so now you see their brain just going, oh, how can I combine, like, what I like to do with this. And so, I mean, even like the podcast we're on today, students are changing, society's changing. They're going into industries that aren't even created yet. The fact that they can come on and create podcasts and TikToks and YouTubes, and, you know, they've figured out that that's what they enjoy, it's kind of the same thing with music. Like, they're getting the ability to express themselves and to see different parts of themselves that they wouldn't normally see anywhere else.
On your organization's website, I read quite a bit about social emotional learning. And of course, as a clinician, I know what that means, but could you explain a bit for our listeners what that means and what role does it play in music education?
Sure. So social emotional learning is a concept that we integrate into education where we have five pillars from CASEL, and they, in a nutshell, what I like to say, or in layman's terms, is we have these five areas, and if we can get students to first recognize and understand what they're feeling, put a name to what they're feeling, understand that what they're feeling is okay, how that operates, and then how to make decisions based on that, it's basically what we do all day. You know, we feel an emotion, we have an experience, we feel an emotion, we make a decision on the next step. Our students aren't always able to do that. They aren't taught that. And so what we do is we're able to bring social emotional learning into the classroom in a really cool way because, you know, there are some students where they like music because even though it seems like it's crazy and wild, it's a place of peace, you know, because we do focus on a lot of, you know, expression in a positive way. Okay, if you're feeling scared or anxious or stressed or mad, you know, what are some of the options that you can do? And then here's some options that you can do that are positive. And I think that in music education, that's something that we, in the K-12 setting, that's something that we really rely on a lot. We're teaching students how to, you know, be expressive, whether they're using scarves or exposure to different types of music with rhythm sticks and playing recorders and playing other instruments. And I think that, you know, that lets students know, hey, there's another way to deal with something. You know, when I'm talking to a first grader and they're like, I feel tingly inside, that's why I was throwing my papers. Well, I don't know what tingly is, so I have to help them help me. So a lot of times, you know, once we can help them develop that language, and then we can say, you know, when you feel tingly, are you scared? Like, are you mad? And sometimes we'll misinterpret the action. So it opens up and it creates a dialogue and a conversation. And so, you know, in music education, we see so many kids. We see every student in school. And so you really get to form relationships. And I always tell the teachers that I supervise, the relationship forming is the first step. When a kid can be vulnerable and they can trust you, that's everything. When you're creating consistency and structure and showing care, that's everything for a kid, especially a kid who may not see that or who may have never known that, right? And so now we're starting to add, oh, I'm validating your feelings. That's mind blowing because kids nowadays are so being pushed to the side. Oh, I don't want to hear you. Go in your room. Oh, here's an iPad. I don't want to, you know, that's not society today. The kids today are very much aware of what's happening around them. And so we have to help them because they're growing up a lot faster, but they're not able to mature at the same rate. And that's where the social emotional learning is just so important. We're trying to get that congruence back. So we can do that through music education.
Thanks. You know, for well over a decade, I was a volunteer art teacher in local schools through hands-on art, and I loved it. It was amazing. But we would go into the schools, and I'm not an artist either, by the way, but it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. We would go into the schools at best every 6 to 8 weeks. It definitely didn't have the weight of like math or science class. And, you know, schools aren't rated on how, effective their kids are at art, but they are rated on, can they do math? So my question is, does that matter? Like, is it important for students to consistently receive the music education, like as a core subject, rather than have it be taught intermittently? Like, what value does it have compared to subjects like math or reading?
Yeah, so I definitely think it's important, but I'm a little biased. But apparently, you know, the the lawmakers think it's important as well. If anyone follows educational policy, we did have an overhauling of the Every Child Something Act, and now it's the Every Student Succeeds Act. And so every few years it keeps reinventing itself. But basically it started off as an act in 1965 that was supposed to create equality across all schools, right? Every school gets everything. That way nobody can say they did not learn something, or, you know, however they want to frame it. And so now they realize the value of having things like arts education back in the schools and why it's so important. There are some skills that you cannot learn from just having math and reading. And if there was, then everyone would be mathematicians and, you know, linguists and things like that. They're, you know, you wouldn't have all these other subsects. And so I think that, you know, unfortunately, we do place a lot of emphasis on math and reading. But it's also like science and social studies also support math and reading. And when we see the focus really balanced amongst that, that helps the math and reading. So guess what? Music is the same thing. You have to start creating a balance for our students. I think also that what starts to happen is if you're seeing students every once and again, they're not growing with you. It's just like, I turned on a light and I turned it off. But if you give them an opportunity to nurture something, to see it from its infancy, and then to grow it every single week, it makes a huge difference. You can't have math once every 6 weeks. You can't have science once every 6 weeks. And I think that that was something that finally started to come back around. And in the Every Student Succeeds Act, it's kind of interesting because writing became a core subject again. Why was that even out to begin with, you know? Computer science, you know, we talk about equity, but during the pandemic, we gave a bunch of kids computers and Chromebooks and laptops and things, and they didn't know how to use it. We had taken business out. And so students didn't know how to type. They know how to thumb type. But when it's like, hey, I have to use a Chromebook, I have to respond in the chat or what have you, they had no knowledge. They didn't know how to create Word documents. There were so many things that they were inept to do. And so it's starting to hit like, hey, these skills need to be in schools. They need to be taught. And each subject has its value. And for music, again, we're so connected and interconnected with every single subject. You're doing history and music. You're doing social studies and music. You're doing math and music. You're doing reading and music. And we actually do support these things. And it's fun because when I go to a campus and I'm talking to an academic teacher, they're like, oh, my student's having trouble, you know, learning the dates for this event in history. And I'm like, put it to a chant. That's music. Put it into a form that the kids are familiar with, that they connect with, that's fun to them, that will help them retain it. Same thing with movement. When we're looking at TKK1 babies, they do a lot of singing. They do a lot of movement because movement has been shown psychologically to help retain information longer and deeper. And so that's the same thing across the board. You know, within music, that's why you can learn a song and then 10 years later, you can still sing that same song. You know, it's kind of like it's stuck in there for some reason. So, you know, we do want to make sure that music isn't just seen as autonomous, but that like having music creates a balance, just like all the other subjects, right? And so it pains me when I go into a school and they're in school for 8 hours and they have 2 hour blocks of math, 2 hour blocks of English, which is what a lot of districts have now moved to. And then they have lunch, recess, and then they have to cram in everything else before they go home. Having more time doing math and doing reading is not gonna, it doesn't necessarily, it's not, it's like causational correlation. For some students, having more time just means I'm gonna have more time to struggle if I don't have those interventions in place. And so, you know, creating that balance, again, it allows kids, their brains to kind of take in the information, right? And so we can do some really creative things. And I think that it's just so necessary.
Thank you.
According to the Jed Foundation, a nonprofit that protects adolescent emotional health and prevents teen suicide through skill building and support, music can play a significant role in promoting wellness in our youth. Music can serve as a distraction from stressors and has been shown to reduce stress and anxiety, lower blood pressure and heart rate, and even lower stress hormones. Music can help listeners identify and express their feelings in an adaptive way and creates a sense of community and belonging, a proven way to improve mental health. Multiple researchers, including Hallam, Rupert, and Schellenberg, have all found that core music education has the following positive impact on children: higher overall grades, fewer school dropouts, and higher self-esteem, confidence, discipline, and emotional intelligence. These findings are supported by an independent multi-year evaluation of the Education Through Music LA impact on the children and schools they serve. Some key findings are: a majority of students said their music classes made them like school more, like themselves more, and feel happier and proud. 87% of teachers said students worked better with peers. 92% of teachers said their students were better engaged in learning. The percent of teachers who reported that students used effective strategies to resolve conflict increased from 46% to 71%. And students who believed hard work would lead to success increased from 57% to 84%. So in preparing for today, Tiffany, I read quite a bit about how music education leads to positive social emotional change in children, and it really changes the school climate. It creates a healthier school climate. Could you share a little bit about the connectedness of music instruction to these changes?
For sure. I have a prime example. I think there was a school that we have served for years, and for one reason or another, we needed to pause at that location. And, you know, music was a very big part of this community, just the parents, the kids, the community, the faculty, like it was just such a big part. And then when we took that hiatus, we started to see some of that unravel. And when you look at what's the only difference, the common denominator is just taking music out, we started to realize, oh, like, this is exactly what we've been trying to fight against. You know, we want to make sure that we can create that stability. And so I think that for a lot of students, again, there are some students that struggle in math and reading, but then they come to music and they feel success and they feel happy and they can express themselves, or they can channel their emotions into an activity, or they can be creative and improvise. So many times kids are told, no, don't do that. And in music, it's like, why not do that? Why do you think you want to do that? Can I do that too? Like, you know, and so you have an opportunity to lead and then also learn and teach all at the same time. If you're a teacher or a student, you're learning every single day. The kids teach me stuff all the time. And so, you know, it's really nice to have music back in the school. And now we're starting to see that it's slowly coming back. But, you know, it's like, I don't want to say the damage has been done, but having that pause, we see the effects of it unraveling, right? We are seeing behaviors are spiraling a little bit more. Attendance numbers are completely different. Students sometimes will come to school just because they want to come for music class. That's okay. And as your music teacher, I'm going to encourage you to come every day. Or, you know, you build that relationship with kids where you're like, I'm going to check with your teacher and make sure that you come on Monday for your test. It's just kind of like we have that opportunity to, again, build so much with these students over the years that we have them. We're the one of the few subjects where we see kids from kinder through eighth grade. You know, sometimes teachers see a kid change for a year. I get to see you for almost 8, 9 years, you know? And so it's like, what kind of growth am I seeing in that time? It's incredible. And so, you know, I think that that's also something that we see historically. I think when I was in school, the cool thing was I knew I could always go to school and see a teacher that I knew. you know, with the state of education today, there's so many people in and out, there's lots of turnover. And sometimes that constant face is the face that you come to school to see, or, you know, the place where you just want to eat your lunch. Or you need that one little check-in where somebody says, did you sleep okay last night? You know, you doing okay? And, you know, we make that a part of the learning for kids, and we create that experience that allows it to be understood by everybody. And then we can create that compassion and that empathy, you know, and kids are getting views of other worlds when they're coming into music, because we have to talk about other places. We have to talk about similarities. And sometimes kids will come in and they're like, I don't want to learn that. I have this misconception. And it's like, no, let's clear it up. Let's talk about it. And there's no judgment here. So, you know, a lot of times students will, again, they'll come and the music classroom is just that space where they can just be. I don't know why it makes it music and not math. But I just think, again, it's a different skill set. You know, when I think about studying math, and I was a good student, but I think about studying math, I was never asked, what did I think about something? It was, how did you get that answer? And then you're going through the same steps that they just taught you how to do. Like, you know, you're just recreating or reproducing, but there was never anything beyond that, you know? And if it was right, it was right. If it was wrong, it was wrong.
Well, and so, music is going to evoke emotions in students that math is just never going to evoke. I mean, music taps into what we're feeling. There's a reason we have breakup playlists and love playlists and workout playlists, yes, because music taps into what we're feeling, doesn't it? And helps us to express it. You know, I was also thinking too, you know, music requires cooperation. The students have to work together as a community to create the song they're making.
Exactly.
And in math or other classes, that's not the case. You don't have to work together,
right,
to an end game.
Right. And it's cool because you can leverage everyone's strength as a team in music. You know, if you're not strong in one area, but you're strong in another area, hey, we can use that too. And we'll find someone else who can, you know, fit into the puzzle the same way. And that's a really cool experience for us to see with kids.
Absolutely. I'm sure no classroom would want me singing, but perhaps I could play a drum, for example. Could you give us maybe a specific example, like if you could share how music education has had a positive impact on a school that you have supervised or served?
Yeah. When I started out my teaching journey, I wanted nothing more than to be a high school band director. And that was what I was when I first started teaching. I started off as a high school band director, and I had gone to a school where the director before me was there for 14 years. So I'm a newbie, fresh out of college, excited. You know, I've got a very different way of approaching things, but I'm following behind someone who had been in this community for 14 years. And I thought it was going to be so easy to just step into that role. You know what I mean? Like, and it was a little bit of a learning curve, but I did notice that once I finally got my footing and my bearing, I started to see the impact on kids. I started to see some behaviors change. And it was like, I couldn't quite put my finger on why it was happening at the time. Now I know it was definitely the social emotional learning, right? It was being able to be vulnerable with students and have them allow them the opportunity to be vulnerable. You know, when kids come in the band room and they want to eat their lunch and they want to listen to the radio station that they want to listen to, and you're like, this is the music we're listening to today. Tomorrow I'll pick something else. You know, we're always going to have a different rotation. You know, kids are like, what? And I'm like, you can eat in here or you can go eat in the cafeteria. Like, you don't have to eat in here. And they'd be like, no, we'd rather eat in here. And then after a while, like, if the music wasn't changing, they'd be like, oh, what's the new song for this day? Like, you know, they would look forward to it. And I'm like, oh, I don't have to argue with you about listening to jazz and stuff, you know? And so, you know, you start to see that, or you start to see students who would come in and you just know by the look on their face that something's going on. And so, you know, you can take a beat to touch base with them, and, you know, they're like, look, just stuff is going on really hard at home, or, you know, like something happened. And you can have a moment where you're like, okay, do you need a minute to just like decompress before you start working with what we're doing today. Like, if you need that time or you need to go cry it out in the bathroom, like, it's okay. And kids appreciate that. You know, I think it's one thing where we have to realize we have to provide that grace and space. And in learning, kids can't learn when their mind is focused on everything else. So we have to create that environment. And I think that that's the impact that I've seen. I've seen kids who've gone on to become musicians, and the majority of my students don't, but I feel good knowing that they're just better people. Like, I don't want to have every student be a musician if that's not their thing, but I want you to be a better person when you leave my classroom. I want you to get life skills and social skills and know that it's okay to laugh and have your own thoughts and, you know, respect other people, and that the world can work in that way. And so, you know, it's great now because my first set of kids are in their late 20s, and I'm like, now they have kids that are old enough for me to teach. I'm like, I remember when you were a bratty teenager, and look at how you've turned into an amazing and incredible adult and a wonderful parent now. So, you know, it's really cool because everybody's going to have that moment. It doesn't happen on the first day. Sometimes it takes a whole school year. But then, you know, you see students down the line and you see that they became the people you always knew they would be. And, you know, to me, that's the positive impact. Can you take that and go back into the community and spread that out, or teach your children, or, you know, hold up those same values? That's kind of the impact that we all hope to see.
You know, as a executive at a community mental health center, I know that schools are often where teachers are the first to notice that a child's having a mental health struggle. Right. Their schools are our biggest referral source. So as an educator, there must be times where you have a student who's having difficulty maintaining their emotional health, their mental health. What positive changes have you seen in those specific students who embrace change through music education?
I want to preface this by saying we have all due respect for every single person who is a part of this interweb of mental health with students, from the counselors to the social workers to the teachers to the parents and everybody in between. It is very difficult to see a child possibly going through, you know, social, emotional, or, you know, mental health issues if you don't know what it looks like. And so one of the things that I am so grateful for was I've had some really incredible principals that I've worked under where they said, we need to teach you what it looks like when a student is in crisis. You need to have training and understand how trauma presents itself so that you're not thinking that a student is just, you know, XYZ. You need to recognize that, you know, if a kid gets in trouble and you're calling home all the time and that kid comes back different, something's happening at home. You know, and maybe that's not the best course of action to go straight to. So having an opportunity to come back to a kid and create a different intervention system for them, everyone doesn't have that opportunity. And I think that through music, again, we get to build these relationships with students over some time. And whether we have you for a year or we have you for 10, it's like, you will see something within yourself. You will see something grow. You will do something you've never done. You'll take risks. You'll try. And sometimes they're scared to do that. So once they feel like that guard is down, you know, they're going to feel a little bit more open. They're going to, you know, embrace it a little bit more. And so I think that for students, whereas they didn't have a voice, music has been a lot of their voices, you know, even though they may all come together at one time to produce it. It's like, I've seen some students who really come out of their shells and they shine and their confidence level goes up. Or, you know, I've even had kids that are like, hey, Ms. Reckley, can you help me with my math? And I'm like, sure, I'll help you with your math. You know, why are you coming to me? Oh, because you just know how to explain things in a patient way, you know? And so I love that students can voice that. And then we can have a conversation and I can say, well, you know, have you tried to talk to your math teacher about that? You know, have you explained to them what you need? You know, and so again, we have this opportunity to then push them to grow themselves as well, because they know they're going to see growth with us. They're seeing that in their music class, and, you know, they may not see that everywhere else. So you know, it's nice to be able to be a part of that change in the communities as well.
Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for just the vitally important work you do, teaching our kids music, but equally as important is creating wellness for them and creating space and giving them an opportunity to find their voice.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
A special thanks to ETMLA alumna Sunny Smith, who performed Wieniawski's Violin Concerto No. 2 in D minor for the opening and interlude of this episode.
It's my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it will be easier for a struggling child to get some help. Ideally, we can all begin to be kinder and more supportive of each other.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.